side of a cell phone, you don't have anywhere near enough real estate to make a true classic slow wave structure. However, what you can do... What you can do with a cell phone is that you can use extremely high dielectric constant materials. There are ceramic materials. Barium tetratitanate is one of them. There are some kinds of exotic ceramic materials which have a dielectric constant as high as 100 and beyond. If you were making, for instance, a piece of transmission line and you use as a dielectric that those fancy kinds of ceramic material with a dielectric constant of 100, it is a well-known factor that the velocity of propagation of your signal down your transmission line is 1 over the dielectric constant of the insulator. So if the insulating material in your coax cable happens to have a dielectric constant of 2, and certain kinds of polyethylene come pretty close, 1 over the square root of 2 is, what is that, square root of 2 is 1.414, and that's where the 66 or 77% velocity factor comes from. If you were using dielectric constant of 100 material, square root of 100 is 10, and therefore the velocity of propagation of a coax cable made out of that material would be 10%. The signal would flow down that cable 10% of the speed of free space. Let me drop. As such, if you use that fancy dielectric material to make a, what you and I would call a rubber duck, but the printed circuit equivalent of that inside of a cell phone is really called a printed, it's a inverted F antenna, a zigzag monopole, it's got various kinds of names. But if you made that particular section of the printed circuit board out of this exotic dielectric 100 material, you could shrink the size of the antenna down by a 10 to 1 ratio because it has a dielectric constant of 100. You gotta be a little bit careful how you do this. I mean, people fall into the trap, and I've been there, where although they can squeeze down the antenna multiple times by using high dielectric constant materials, they think they're going to simultaneously get high gain out of that antenna. If you think you're going to simultaneously get high gain out of the antenna at the same time you're shrinking it down, Mother Nature's laws of physics won't allow you to do that. If the whole world was made out of that ceramic material, and you're launching the signal into that ceramic stuff in free space, so to speak, the way you laid it out would give you gain. But in the case of a high dielectric material within the antenna structure itself, Mother Nature doesn't give a damn about what you do within the antenna as long as you establish resonance and as long as there is something that's exposed to the outside air so that the resonant signal, the energy bouncing back and forth the antenna, gets a chance to couple into space. The gain of the antenna is a function of the number of wavelengths of physical aperture you present to the air. You're going to launch that signal into air. If that, there's a rough rule of thumb, for instance, for a feed horn. You take the number of wavelengths of width of the feed horn, divide it into 70 degrees, and that gives you the beam width. I'll give you an example. If you were able to make your particular feed horn have a mouth diameter that is 7 wavelengths wide, 7 into 70 gives you 10, you would have 10 degrees of beam width out of the feed horn, and you could take that feed horn, which is 7 wavelengths wide, and if you did it at 10 gigs, where wavelength is 1 inch, the horn would be 7 inches wide. In theory, you can make that horn out of dielectric constant material of 100, where everything gets shrunk down by 10 to 1, so instead of the horn being 7 inches wide, it could be 7 tenths of an inch wide. Let me drop. And if the whole world had that dielectric material inside the horn as well as outside the horn that is 7 tenths of an inch wide would have the gain, would have 10 degrees of beam width, which would probably be something like 18 dB of gain. Very nice, as long as the ceramic material was everywhere. In the real world, you can build that horn instead of 7 inches wide, you can make it 7 tenths of an inch wide, by inside the horn is made out of dielectric 100 material. But when the game is all over with inside of the horn, you've launched that signal into air. As far as the air is concerned, 7 tenths of an inch wide of a horn is going to have 100 degrees of beam width, not 10 degrees of beam width. So it's the number of wavelengths of aperture that you present to the air that gives you the gain indoor beamwidth of the antenna. A lot of people fall into that trap. So you can call an antenna made out of dielectric materials.
Dielectric ceramic materials or whatever. So
about any transmission line, I can slow down the signal, goes to a certain length. If my coaxial cable was made out of air as a dielectric, the velocity factor for a radio wave in air is 1 nanosecond per foot. Every foot that your radio signal has to go through takes it 1 nanosecond in time for it to traverse that foot. So each foot of coaxial cable has a nanosecond of foot of delay inside the coax cable. As I start making the coax cable out of higher and higher dielectric materials for the insulator, the signal becomes delayed. Okay? Every antenna really is a resonator. In other words, the signal has to flow down the antenna, get to the end, reflect off the end, and come back to the beginning. Every antenna really is a kind of a transmission line. Every antenna that you've ever built is a kind of transmission line, but the center conductor of the transmission line, so to speak, leaks into space. So some of the energy is leaking out, but the signal has to flow down the antenna, has a certain length of time for it to do it. The velocity factor of the antenna, depending on what materials you use and how you zigzag it, you can make the antenna out of a resonator. Let me drop. You can make the antenna out of a resonator where it's a coiled inductor, so to speak. Helical wound radiator. The helical wound radiator is a kind of slow wave structure because of the extra length of that helix. For the length of the helix, physical length, from tip to beginning, so to speak, it takes longer for the signal to get there. So there's various ways of making an antenna more compact. A top hat capacitor at the end will shrink it down. A loading inductor at the beginning will shrink it down. Zigzagging it will shrink it down physically. Helical winding it. So all of these are slow wave structures because every antenna is a resonator that radiates. It's a leaky resonator. The signal has to bounce back and forth. It has to flow through the whole physical length of the antenna in order to do its bouncing and resonating. And the length, the speed at which it does that traversing of your antenna structure determines how much you can physically shrink down the antenna and still bring it back into resonance. And even if the antenna, let me drop. And even if the antenna is not long enough to be resonant at your frequency, it's a little bit too short. Therefore, the signal that you want to bounce is going to come back too soon. And it's going to give you a capacitive reactance because it comes back too soon. By way of the antenna tuner, the inductor and the capacitor in the antenna tuner is the additional delay network, another slow wave structure. Very similar to that coax cable I described, you can build as a simulated coax of a whole bunch of series inductors and shunt capacitors. So now the extra delay to take your antenna that's too short to bring it back into resonance, the antenna tuner can do that. Is the antenna tuner an impedance matcher? Yes. Is it another delay circuit that brings it into resonance? Yes. Which is it doing? It's doing all of the above. Simultaneously, when it does its impedance matching, all of the reflected signal from your transmission line, so to speak, with your antenna tuner in the shack, all of that reflected signal hits the antenna tuner, gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter right now, and in a voltage manner, they get added. That's the reason why if you've got a high vis wire antenna and you put your bird watt meter after your antenna tuner, you know that your transmitter only runs 100 watts of output. You may see 150 watts of forward power with your bird watt meter, and you'll say, gee, that can't be real. It is real. Because the signal is bouncing back and forth, the instantaneous forward signal could easily be 150 watts, but only 100 watts of it is being radiated, if you know what I mean, because of the vis wire of the antenna. That's some of the story. There's a lot more to it, but maybe that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. So, simply can we just assume that we are actually, with this metamaterial or whatever it is, we're making a longer path for the wave to travel, even though the antenna is far shorter than you would calculate?
That's a good way of putting it, John. You can make phony dielectric materials, slow wave structures, out of what's called metamaterial. You can make it out of distributed inductors and capacitors and zigzagging and helical winding. We can make it out of high dielectric ceramic materials, a high dielectric constant of 100. No matter what means you use, you want to make the electrical length of the resonating system resonant at your frequency. You want it to be a quarter wave, half wave, or whatever. Some number of quarter wavelength of electrical length is what's required for an antenna, so that the signal can bounce back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated, and all of those bounces stay in step with each other, co-phase. That's what resonance is. So you can make antennas physically small by using various techniques of metamaterials, high dielectric constant, zigzagging, helical winding, and whatever, that you can electrically keep the antenna the right length electrically, even though physically it's too short. You pay the price. When you do whatever you've done to make the antenna physically short, the example I often use is, let me drop. I take an 80 meter half wave dipole that should be 132 feet long, and I've decided to physically make it 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. If I look at the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can see by that website I always keep telling you guys about, Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org, WA1MBA.org. You go there and you go to the bottom of the page, you'll find the dipole and Yagi matching by K2LIW, and you look at those curves. You'll discover that when you make the antenna one-third or one-quarter of the physical length that it should be, it's now going to be highly capacitive in reactance when you feed it in the center. The resistance comes down a little bit, but the main thing that happens is you get a huge capacitive reactance. That's a fancy way of saying the signal you send down that antenna, it bounces off the end and comes back too soon electronically. That's what a high capacitive phase impedance really means. You can now create multiple methods of creating electrical delay of that signal, because now that antenna is too short, is not resonant. You can force it into electronic resonance by an antenna tuner, dielectric. All of those techniques that I told you about before to be into electronic resonance. Once you've made it electronically resonant, even though it's too short, it will radiate with nearly 100% efficiency. That's the good news. But because it is so short physically, the amount of energy it radiates on each bounce is smaller, because radiation requires real estate. The length of the wire determines what percentage of the antenna signal bouncing back and forth, the antenna energy, gets jumped into space, so to speak. So when you make the antenna short, less and less energy gets radiated on each bounce. Therefore, it takes more and more bounces. Instead of 20 bounces, it may take 100 bounces to radiate that signal because it's too short. Now you've got to keep 100 bounces in step instead of 20 bounces in step. That's a higher Q structure. Now with that shorter antenna, your QSY 30 kilohertz, and you've got to readjust the antenna tuner. Whereas the full-length half-wave dipole, you didn't have to do that. So you pay the price. You make the antenna short. You make the antenna too short. You can force it into...
K2RIW testing. Not coming out of H5 yet. Oh, yes, I am.
receiver's tuned to the wrong place. So, what was I starting to say? You had a question, John, and I was starting to answer the other half of it. Metamaterials, point-signature resonance. By the way, this guy right now is S9 plus 30. He's driving by my house right now on the input. Okay, radiation requires resonance. Resonance requires electronically, you make the antenna some number of quarter wavelengths or half wavelengths long, so that all those signals bouncing back and forth stay in step with each other. That's what resonance is. That's what gives you the multiplication of current. The multiplication of current gives you a multiplication of magnetic field. The multiplication of magnetic field is, in my opinion, that which is the first step that starts the radiation process. KC2WG, AB, KQRIW. Go ahead, John. John, are you on the 449?
He's still talking, Dick.
I've got him.
Interfere with RFID tags. Maybe you could explain how that works.
Now, you asked the question about interfering with RFID tags. There's multiple ways of talking about that one. Stand by a second.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. For the time being, I'll use this one, and I'll switch over to the other one when I have to. The RFID tag. The RFID tag starts its operation by taking the RF signal it receives, rectifying it. That charges a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery that runs the integrated circuit. The integrated circuit allows you to modulate the tag identification number, which is usually 96 bits of information. That gives you everything you want to know about that tag. With 96 bits, oh boy, you have billions and billions of combinations. By comparison to a barcode, for instance, where you've only got 12 or 14 bits of information, there's no as much information. You've got a lot of repetitive information on those barcode tags. There's not enough barcode numbers to cover every single item in that store, if you know what I mean. So some of them have to be duplicated. Okay. In the case of the RFID tag, the modern-day RFID tag, let me drop. The modern-day RFID tag requires a identification called a handshake. It's got another name. I can't think of it right now. In other words, the signal you send to it starts off with a steady-state high-power signal with no modulation. That charges the capacitor. Then you give it a particular code, which the tag recognizes, and it recognizes you as a valid interrogator transceiver, and you then give it a piece of information. Hey, I want all tags to talk to me right now, or I want only the tags that begin with the serial number A1 or A1A. I only want those particular tags to talk to me right now. So that identification, that's a handshake, that's a, I can't think of it's got a fancy name. But the original message you send to the tag could be corrupted by a strong local transmitter. If a person, for instance, is standing alongside of that RFID tag with an operating cell phone, the cell phone, although it's far removed in frequency, the tag itself has got a very broadband dipole antenna and a simple rectifying network. It has no tuning. You could be 150 megacycles away from the right frequency on that tag. Your tag may be a 915 megahertz tag, and you're transmitting a signal to it a few hundred megs away. As such, that signal might be so darn strong because of proximity, it dominates, and therefore the tag might not see your identification, your addressing, that's the word they're looking for. You have to address the tag, you have to give it a particular code, and tell it whether or not you want all tags to talk or certain tags to talk. Without the tag receiving that addressing code, the tag will not respond. This is the usual protocol for tags being used in the United States today. There's a whole series of tags that are being used in Europe that have a much simpler protocol where the tag will talk as long as any signal comes to it. It will talk. In other words, the tag will even talk when a cell phone is there. And by the way, the signal reflected from the tag is so small, so weak, it takes a specific receiver to listen to that sleep power signal from the tag. So don't worry about a European tag that doesn't require an addressing code, and you're alongside of it with your cell phone. That tag is not going to interfere with your cell phone operation. Maybe that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Local transmission. All right. What if the tag was adjacent to the main magnet? Would that affect? Which is another one of his questions. Maybe you can handle that.
I think the answer. I think the answer is almost absolutely not, John. The tag is really the most popular kind of UHF tag being used in the United States. Runs between 902 and 928 megs. A slight variation of that version used in Europe runs at 816 megs, I think it is. Anyhow, it's a very broadband dipole rectifier looking for RF energy. The energy you can put onto that dipole is what gets rectified, that charges the capacitor, that runs the integrated circuit chip. A simple steady-state magnetic field absolutely will not do it. If you had a magnetic field that is modulating at a very high rate, I guess it is possible to take, let me pick a number, a 5-megacycle, very strong magnetic field, and put it near the tag, and with enough of that signal by Faraday's law, be coupled to that dipole, therefore get rectified by the diode, and therefore run the circuit. Yes, it is possible, but rather unlikely. Will steady-state bar magnet do it? No way. It is a RF-responsive circuit, not a magnetic field-responsive circuit. Yes, I'm saying that electromagnetic wave has a lot of magnetic phenomena to it, but it's at an RF rate in order to resonate with the dipole to put significant energy on the dipole of the tag. A steady-state bar magnet alongside is not going to do that, John, as I see it. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
You know, I'm just thinking of that question we had before with the metamaterial type of antennas. Do they use slow wave structure for the antennas in RFID tags, by the way?
I think the answer to that is sort of yes, John. When it comes to the interrogator, a number of brands of popular interrogator have a flat plate antenna on the front end, which really is a turnstile antenna. In other words, there's a horizontal dipole and a vertical dipole built into the ceramic of that flat plate on the front end of the RFID reader, the handheld reader. In order to shrink that down to a reasonable size, they've made it out of high dielectric constant ceramic material. So now the physical size of the dipole is nice and small, not a very heavy object for you to carry around. Although in some cases that ceramic material is very brittle. You drop some of those brands on the ground, you shatter the antenna that's on the front end of it. That's another whole issue. But the tag itself almost never is made out of high dielectric materials because these high dielectric materials in general are expensive. The manufacturers of the tag are right now fighting the problem of the fact that most of the tags presently in use are in the vicinity of 25 cents a piece. By the way, a barcode is probably a small fraction of one penny, maybe 0.05 cents a piece, if you know what I mean. So putting barcodes on everything in the world is easy. Tags, you have to put them on slightly higher value items, like clothing and ordnance and whatever. You're not going to put an RFID tag on a stick of gum, because the RFID tag today is around $25, 25 cents. The manufacturers are fighting very hard, looking forward to the day when each RFID tag is a nickel or less in mass production. They haven't gotten there yet. As such, the use of high dielectric materials, the metamaterials and whatever, in order to achieve smaller size, not likely because of the cost requirement. I think you see what's going on there, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Thank you for the great answers. And let's see if Paul's out there. And I know he's got a space report for us. But very good. We shall take it up and see what else we get next week. Back to you, Dave.
Very fine, John. I'm going to turn it over to Paul, and let me do a quick test here. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, level link is a little bit noisy for me. I think the best you're going to do tonight, Paul, is on 147.375. So I recommend you use 147.375 for the space record. And if that doesn't work over, maybe I'll have you flip stuff back and forth, depending on where that mobile guy is located. WS2N for the space report. K2RIW to TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, sir.
Yeah, that is a little bit noisy, Paul. Give us a brief transmission on 8-5. Let's see how that works. WS2N, K2RIW.
The swing is beam around, Dick. I hear myself. This is WS2N. How copy?
For the time being, the copy is very good, Paul. So let's start off this way. Make each of your transmissions a little bit short. Well, you have to interrupt every minute to make sure you don't time out the machine. And on each minute, I'll let you know how it's going. You might have to do some flipping back. You may have to do some flipping back and forth, like I did. Make a brief transmission now, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
I'll take care. Don't worry about it.
Very good, Eric. Looks like Eric's got it under control, Paul. WS2N, proceed this way, K2LIW.
Very good. Here's what we have for the space report. Four items. One is the signal headed to the International Space Station. That's the one that's built by Orbital Science. Also built by, and this is the second shot step to the space station. First one was on their own demonstration flight with a quarter. This is surreal for them because they're actually being paid by NASA. These are what $1 billion deals with NASA. In this case, they have eight flights to the space station for the next couple of years. Especially Obama just allowed more funding for the space station. Read the telemetry.
engage. He's driving by my house right now. I'm going to have to tell Paul to go over to the other frequency. Yeah, it looks like we're going to have to use 975-375, Paul, and I think you're going to have to aim your antenna at that particular repeater. So we'll stand by while you aim your antenna at that particular repeater, Paul. As you can tell, mine is aimed to the west right now. WS2N, T2LIW.
Yeah, I can tell by the input. I know which way you're going. I'm almost there. This is WS2N. Giving you about 10 more seconds.
Copy is very good. You are a lot quieter than I am. My antenna is aimed in the wrong direction right now, Paul. Proceed, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW.
Yeah, this rotator works. Winter, summer, ice, it doesn't care. It's unbelievable. Second thing I wanted to mention was last week we talked about the Gaia mission. That's the one that was launched by the European Space Agency to the L2 point location. At that time last week, it hadn't gotten there yet. Now it's there. Everything's operating. They're checking some of the CCDs, making sure everything's coming online. Everything is 100%, they said. So that looks good. We're looking at the 1 billion stars, 1% of the stars that are in our galaxy. So, looking forward to that. This new system that they have is going to be able to see where the stars are going, how far they're moving, and other things too, including looking for different planets to drop it. The science that they call, what they're doing is called astrometry. Astrometry. It's been going on for hundreds of years. This Hipparchus guy, he started that hundreds of years ago, recording the stars. And then they actually named the spacecraft after him back in the early 90s. And that recorded 100,000 stars. Well, this thing's going to do 1 billion stars. So it's a pretty good machine. I emailed you a link for the Gaia information. I sent John one too. And it gives you all the what the scientists are really. It's pretty good. Drop it. It's a pretty good website. The one you can get all the information about the Gaia spacecraft and what the scientists expect to get out of that mission. Another thing I want to talk about was the ammonia pump that was repaired on the International Space Station. We were wondering, I didn't know at the time, what happened to the first pump back in 2010? We know it was the same location on the starboard side. But what did they do with that pump? Did they force it through the airlock? Did they, push it behind the space station and let it burn up in the atmosphere? What happened? It turns out they did bring it back. I thought they did, but I wasn't too sure. On a space shuttle, well, final space shuttle mission, STS-135. They had a special rig set up inside the shuttle bay. They attached it on a final spacewalk to it, and they brought it home. And they confirmed what they believe was the problem. So a problem, it turns out to be some kind of a short in the box itself inside the 780-pound pumping machine that pumps ammonia around, and a short sure enough, that was the problem. Now, this last problem, it's not this, you know, it's a completely different deal. So I'd like to find out what that is. I haven't really found out on the last one there a couple of months ago when that creeped up. They successfully relocated that pump as well. And where are they getting all these pumps from? They knew this was a critical system. One of about a dozen types of things that could possibly go wrong on the space station that could really cause a problem and almost end the space station mission. So they thought about it ahead of time, and they put four spare pumps up there on these external stowage platforms, ESPs. They roll over the space station, and they got all kinds of equipment attached to this, spare parts. So they did have four, and they've used up two now. So there's two in operation. There's one on the port side, one on the starboard side. So there were four extras. They've already used two over the last 3 years, and now there's two left. So they're in pretty good shape as long as they don't fail. And maybe in the future they'll be able to send different ones up there, either using the Cygnus spacecraft that's up there now, or maybe SpaceX, or some of the other ones that are being developed by different companies, which we've gone over on that before. I can always review them, if, you know, now or in the future. Boeing is one of them. So that's pretty much where they stand there. Talking about the Cygnus, they'll be docked to the space station until mid-February. They'll load it up with trash, all kinds of garbage, anything they want to get rid of. Not scientific instruments that have to be returned, because the Cygnus is one of these spacecraft that has really done its mission after it leaves the space station. It will burn up over the Pacific Ocean, unlike SpaceX, now, because they'll be unberthing from the Harmony mode. That's the only docking port that the American side is the Harmony node common berthing mechanism. So Cygnus will undock, and right after that, SpaceX will launch its Falcon 9 rocket. On top of that, the Dragon spacecraft, which will dock to the same location, and they'll be able to unload all of their cargo. We drop it. Interesting thing that happened with Orbital Science, they worked delayed the day. They were going to go up the day before, but there was a solar flare. Solar flares are rated in it's kind of like a logarithmic system. You know, they have A, B, C. You know, each one is getting stronger and stronger. Then they go up to they jump from the letter C to M, like in Mike, and then they go right to X for X-ray. Well, this was an X, so it was a very large flare. They were worried about it possibly getting into the electronics of the spacecraft, so they held off on it. Actually, it was larger than an X. It was an X, X1.2. So, you know, you've got an X1, you've got an X2, which is, you know, each time it's, 10 times more powerful than the next. It's logarithmic, and this was X1.2. It's one of the big ones, and that's enough for them to hold off on a launch. The crew on the space station was safe. Van Allen belt kind of like helps them out, but they don't want to take any chances when they're launching a spacecraft, whether it's manned or unmanned. That's pretty much it. Let me drop it. Any questions, you could write to me. Okay, I have an email, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Hope I got through, Dick. K2RIW is the space portion of TechNet. This is WS2N.
Absolutely, Paul.
sounded good. When your antenna is aimed at this repeater, you come through very well on the western link, so to speak. So every bit of that came through extremely well. And the jammer did flip over to this frequency. I was listening to him on the input as he drove by my house. So he was trying real hard, but he didn't succeed. He was 60 over 9 at my house, depending on which one of the transmission frequencies he was using. Astrometry is what I think you're describing. And I think you think Gaia is going to measure 1 billion stars. I'm kind of curious, first of all, what's different about Gaia that allows it to measure 1 billion stars, whereas Kepler measured something like 100,000? How in the world did they make it that much more, keep working on that many more stars? How in the world did they do that? It's question number one. And give me a rough guess, as I see it, Paul, roughly when will Gaia be operational? It's going to Lagrange point number 2, I believe, which is the one that's 1 million miles away on the backside of the Earth, away from the Sun. And what's your best guess as to when Gaia will be operational? So when operational, and how in the world, and I got that email from you, but I didn't review it yet. Maybe they explain how in the world Gaia can be looking at 1 billion stars simultaneously instead of 100,000. WS2N, SpaceNet, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I've listened to an interview, on that website, if you play it back, they tell you about it, but the interview that I saw was pretty good at down at our French Guyana, you know, they interviewed one of the mission scientists. They talk about this 1 billion pixel. Is that right word? 1 billion pixel camera on board. It's supposed to be, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands times more powerful than any other camera that's ever gone up. And these are, I guess, photo camera type of things. Similar to what Kepler had. And whatever Kepler had, this thing's got like thousands more, you know, and thousand times more. So that's the one way they're going to do it. The scanning system, you'll see the spacecraft. It looks like if you take a cupcake and put it onto a paper plate, put that right in the middle of a paper plate, and space the paper plate toward Earth and the Sun, and have the rest of it sticking out, and the lens, instead of pointing straight out, you know, like the Hubble, you know, in line with the whole tube setup, we drop it. They have the opening the aperture on the side. If you take like this cupcake, then take the side of the cupcake and put a big hexagon hole in it. That's where your light's going to go through. It's going to hit a mirror on the side, on the inside, and then reflect all around inside the inside Gaia until it gets to the CCD section. And they have, I think, 5 different CCD types of cameras in there, you know. I mean, it's not just one big camera. So, as the spacecraft spins and rotates, you know, one or two revolutions per minute or something, you drop it, it will scan the entire sky. As it goes around the Sun, you're going to collect more and more information because that angle changes. And this is going to go on for years. And in 1 year, every year, it's going to scan the same part of the sky 70 different times, I guess, with all the spinning of the spacecraft. They're all going to add up to 70 different times. Now, by having all these different pieces of information from all these different time sets, they can tell where all the stars are, where they're going to be moving to, from us, away from each other. And they'll be able to actually make, for the first time, a truly accurate three-dimensional map of the whole Milky Way, for instance.
I'm slowly getting the picture, Paul. Amazing. So this thing is continuously rotating, a little bit like the microwave anisotropy probe, WMAP, Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. It was continuously rotating, and therefore making these stripes across the sky and keeping track of all of that accumulated data. I have the impression that Gaia is doing something similar. And if it makes a revolution, one or two revolutions per minute, and that particular star that you're studying right now is in the field of view for, let me pick a number, the next day or two, and if a planet traverses across the surface of that star during that day, you catch that piece of information. But the star is actually, the planet is in front of the star for something in the vicinity of an hour and a half. And you have to carefully catch the beginning and end of that hour and a half in order to time and measure. The measurement by the amount of dip of the light from the star tells you how big the planet is, and the amount of time it takes for the planet to traverse the disk of the sun of that star tells you something about how big the orbit is. But now, if Gaia is continuously scanning at right angles to its axis of rotation, and I'm going to guess the axis of rotation is always aimed toward the sun and Earth. So therefore, depending on how wide in elevation is the field of view, you're only looking at a particular star for some number of days, and now it's out of the field of view until 6 months later. So therefore you're getting rather interrupted data by comparison to Kepler, if I'm understanding correctly. But maybe I'm misunderstanding this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's exactly like WMAP in that respect. Well, exactly like Planck, too. Of course, they were looking at the universe, and this thing is trying to concentrate basically on the stars in the Milky Way. And actually it's going to pick up planets too. Somehow they don't talk about that in the email that I sent you in that, about the planets. That was on the interview. The bottom of that email page is where there's a video. And they show you part of that. What they show you is exactly what you're saying, the stripes, it creates the stripes in the sky. And if you've ever seen the, you'll see a sky map, for instance, WMAP, any of these, COBE, you look at these maps, and somebody doesn't know what they're looking at, and, how could that be the whole sky, but when you watch a video like this, the first time I ever saw a good one was Planck, and they had the same type of video. And you see these stripes, just like what you said, that are being formed surrounding the spinning spacecraft. And then as it goes, they open it up, they make it flat to look at a flat version of what you're really looking at. You're really looking at something that's surrounding you, which is pretty cool. You can get a good idea when you that video. I know you know that, Dick, but anybody else wants to do that, that's what they're doing. Look for the Gaia, anything on Gaia. I guarantee you're going to find a video dealing with that topic. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
The COBE display, the WMAP display, and the one that's going to replace it, the SF spacecraft, I keep forgetting the name of it, they take the whole spherical universe. I mean, the universe, you could say, is painted on the inside of a sphere, and you're inside that sphere. And now, by conic sections and a whole lot of other mapping techniques in the past, we've tried to take a spherical map of your continents and islands and whatever of the Earth, and display it on a flat map. and it's rather difficult. But one of those display techniques is called a Mali-Weiss plot. I think it's pronounced Mali-Weiss, where when you look at it, it looks like a great big oval. But if you know what you're looking at, your equator, so to speak, is right down the center of the long dimension of that oval, and everything else is a bunch of curved lines. But the whole spherical object is being displayed in that oval, which sometimes is called Mali-Weiss display technique. And so I'm getting the impression that when you wait for at least 6 months, Gaia will fill up at least that map on the first pass, so to speak. Now, is the main object of Gaia to look for exoplanets, or is it to make astrometry measurements of the stars and find all the variable stars? What is the main motivation there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I got an accurate look at 1 billion stars, which is basically from our Milky Way. Relationship between all of them, whether or not they're moving toward one another or away from one another, how fast they're moving. To describe the accuracy of it, something like looking at a button on the spacesuit of a spacewalker walking on the moon from Earth, some bizarre. You know, I mean, this is, I can't believe the accuracy they're going to get out of this, but that's what they're doing. 1 billion stars, basically making a 3D picture of the surroundings. They don't have an accurate description of all the different arms in the Milky Way. That's what they want to do. They want to really perfect that. And then, in the process, it's going to pick up, you know, transient planets going across. But yeah, number one is the fact that if you look at that video, they don't talk about planets. They just talk about snapping the stars. So that's pretty much what it is. The thrusters on board, tiny little thrusters. Each one is going to produce like something like 1/1,000,000th of the equivalent of what a normal thruster would be used for the maneuvering in space. So they don't even talk about momentum wheels or anything. They're still going to be done with these thrusters. It's hard to believe, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah, I think I've seen techniques by which you can have solar panels where there's the equivalent of pin feathers on the end of the solar panel, and the solar pressure hitting those pin feathers that you aim in various ways can give you a small amount of thrust that you get free of charge. And you've got these micro thrusters you're describing. I'm getting the impression that Gaia is not only going to be doing accurate mapping of all the stars, but by doing it for a full year period, and therefore you're getting the whole astronomical unit twice as a baseline of the triangle, I'm getting the impression they're going to be measuring the range of many of those stars in our galaxy, therefore do a more accurate mapping of the arms of our galaxy. Is that the major purpose of Gaia? Is a ranging mapping, accurate mapping with ranging, and if in the meantime they pick up some blips because of planets, that's secondary, but it's not the primary motivation for Gaia, is my guess. Is that close from your impression, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
That's what I did get out of it, yeah. So, incredible as it sounds. And from what I see, NASA is not involved in it. It's the European Space Agency project. So, I don't think the taxpayer in the United States is on the arm for any of this. I haven't found one thing that talks about